If you're ever interested in the life science industry, please take the time to study it to better understand, because a lot of physicians come in with a preconceived idea, and I would say in 92% the preconceived idea is wrong. The second huge difference is everything in an industry, in a business, most of it is a teamwork. As physician, we're solo practitioner. We're the captain of the ship or captain of the plane. In industry, it is a teamwork. So again, I found physicians to have difficulties because they always made their decision solo. In a business, it's a joint decision.
Welcome to Pemba On Demand. I'm Norm Chapin, your host. I am very excited to welcome you to our podcast. Pemba On Demand is produced for physicians interested in professional development. We will be discussing a wide range of topics on the podcast. I will be interviewing physician leaders from the U.S. and from other countries who have graduated from the Physician Executive MBA program at the University of Tennessee. These physicians will be sharing stories of professional and personal growth, overcoming challenges in their organizations, and discussing key leadership skills they have learned from the MBA program and ongoing professional development. Welcome to episode 26 of Pemba On Demand. The team at the University of Tennessee Physician Executive MBA program is very excited to be celebrating the one-year anniversary of Pemba On Demand podcasts. We have been releasing bi-weekly episodes now for an entire year. Our first episode was released on November 16th, 2023. Our guest on that show was Dr. Rinku Mehra. We have presented a variety of topics over the past year, from artificial intelligence, concierge medicine, entrepreneurship, physician leadership, quality, innovation in healthcare, and many others. The 25 podcasts have been downloaded or streamed 486 times, along with 45 listens on Spotify over the past year. The Pemba On Demand live streams and visits to our YouTube channel to view the video podcasts have generated 679 views and created nearly 8,000 impressions over the past year. The channel currently has 42 subscribers. So we are very excited to continue to bring these episodes to you, and we are excited that you're finding value in these episodes and hope to be able to continue to provide you with the content that you are interested in and that helps you grow as leaders in healthcare. Today's guest, Dr. Francois Nader, is an alumnus from the Pemba program. He completed his MBA back in 2000. Dr. Nader trained in France and will share today his career in the biotech or life science industry over the past four decades. Dr. Nader brings tremendous experience to you and has a great deal to share regarding the opportunities for physicians in this industry. Dr. Nader has risen to top executive roles in the industry, including CEO roles. He also serves on many boards in the industry and has expertise with mergers and acquisitions. Welcome to Pemba On Demand. Our show today is titled, From Medicine to Moderna, How Physicians Are Breaking Into Biotech. Our guest today is Dr. Francois Nader. Dr. Nader currently serves on the board of directors of Moderna. He also serves on the board of directors at Ring Therapeutics. He is also the chairman at Genie Life Sciences and serves as a senior advisor for Blackstone Life Sciences. So once again, buckle up and get ready for a fascinating conversation about careers in biotech and life sciences. Stay tuned, because you won't want to miss a minute of this. So, Dr. Nader, I am very, very excited to welcome you to Pemba On Demand.
Pleasure to be here, and please call me Francois like everyone else.
Thank you, Francois. Well, I appreciate you taking time to join us today. I've been looking forward to this interview for a long time. I wonder if you could start just by sharing a little bit about your journey in medicine and where you started and how you got involved in the biotech or life science industry.
Well, I'm from Lebanese origin, so I did my medical studies in Lebanon at the French Faculty of Medicine of Beirut. So I was granted a French degree. And then because of the civil war in Lebanon, we decided to move to France, and I was waiting actually for my residency in ophthalmology in Montreal. And being in Paris with my wife and two children was challenging. So a friend of mine actually asked me if I would consider joining a company called Sanofi as a consultant for a short period of time, since I was waiting and did not have much else to do. And I said, sure, why not? And actually, it turns out that the role was to be a medical consultant for the Pasteur vaccine business. And it was a tenure of 6 months, which turned out to be, call it 30 plus years, I guess. Since then, that was what defined my career, an opportunity that I really did not seek, but I grabbed out of necessity. And the rest, as we say, is history.
It's interesting how often our careers and our professional lives are impacted by these options or opportunities that we have that just present themselves.
Yeah, and it's fascinating because I had to explain to my father probably about 15 times why a doctor would end up in the pharma industry. I don't think he never forgave me for that.
So while you were waiting for your ophthalmology residency, first of all, did you ever hear from any of the residency programs in Canada that you were waiting to hear from?
No, yes, actually, I was accepted and then I respectfully declined. I was so fascinated, frankly, fascinated really by a field that I really did not have any idea about. But the concept, I mean, and this was one of major driver of my career, is just the concept of being able to help millions, literally, rather than helping one patient at a time. I found the concept fascinating. And back then, we were at the verge of developing the first hepatitis B vaccine, which was, and it was the AIDS period in the early 80s. I mean, there was so much going on in immunology that I said, you know something, this is something that is so exciting. And I would do my immunology training at the Pasteur while actually doing my day job, which was also an interesting challenge. So it was this, I would say, intersection between opportunity, but also a vision that it's a different role and it's an exciting one, just making a difference for millions of individuals rather than one at a time.
So besides the fact that you were involved in a particular vaccine development, were there other things about working in the life sciences industry or biotech that you found particularly appealing? You talked about having a larger impact, more than just one patient at a time as well. But I wonder if there were other things that you found particularly satisfying from a professional standpoint that kept you in the industry.
Yeah, actually, it's the other aspect that was fascinating was the fact that I did not have a clue what I was doing. Because the industry, I mean, the life science industry is an industry, and in our medical training, frankly, we're not exposed to what it is. We assume that we know, but until you get there, you really don't know what you don't know. And for me, the other aspect, which has been, frankly, a guiding principle of why I've been interested and continue to be interested in the industry, is the learning. This is an industry where you learn every day, literally every day, because this is an industry that is very dynamic in its innovation. And frankly, what you learned last year or 6 months ago might or might not be true today. So it has been a journey of learning, and it continues to be a journey of learning, which I find really fascinating from multiple different perspectives. And corollary to this, it's a learning in multiple different disciplines, because when you are in the biotech industry, and on Monday you talk about oncology, on Tuesday you talk about gastroenterology, and on Thursday you talk about immunology, and then on Sunday you talk about rare diseases. So it is a permanent learning, and I found this absolutely intriguing.
Do you think that the opportunities for physicians in this industry, biotech, pharma, life sciences, are great as they were when you began several decades ago?
Much bigger today. I was more or less the exception. Very few physicians actually were in the industry when I joined. And now we have a number of positions that are held by physicians. Mm-hmm. It ranges from really research to translational medicine to clinical development to regulatory to safety, very important. But also, when you think of it, it's also other positions like population health or health economics, and you branch out from there all the way to commercial positions at times, and again, CEO positions eventually, or head of R&D. So not only the physicians are now accepted in the industry, actually they're sought after, and in many positions that were frankly not open to physicians, they are open now and in great numbers. And we have a number of physicians who decide either to switch career early, as I did, or mid-career and or late career. So the door is definitely open.
What do you think led to that kind of culture change or that transformation within these companies to have a totally different recognition of the value that physicians bring to the companies?
I think it's twofold. I think the industry has shifted dramatically from selling to educating. And this is where the role of physicians can be very clear and very key. But also, the innovation is such now that it's becoming more and more sophisticated. And this is why, where the, if you will, the background of medicine is very pertinent every day. So it is a combination of innovation and transformation of the business model, mainly. And you add to this the notion of compliance that is becoming more and more, if you will, specific and more stringent. And again, it opens the door for physicians to play in this field as well.
Are there particular backgrounds or specialties, skill sets maybe would be a better word for it, that physicians bring to the companies that are most sought after?
Yes and no. So the yes question is there are therapeutic areas that are in higher demand than others, oncology being top of the list probably. But at the same time, the industry covers literally all aspects of medicine. And the challenge or the opportunity, frankly, for physicians is to find the niche where they can contribute their medical knowledge to what the firm is asking for at a given time. So, for example, someone who's an orthopedic surgeon would find their niche probably in medtech companies that develop tools or equipment or supplies related to orthopedic surgery. Someone has a training in oncology, probably working with a company that develops oncology products would be the right fit. This being said, we also have a great demand for generalists because, as I said, when you join a company, usually you're exposed to different therapeutic areas, and internist or general medicine or folks with a broad expertise could also deploy their expertise in multiple different ways.
So in your experience, what are the most common steps or activities that a physician should take if they were trying to position themselves to take advantage of an opportunity in this industry?
Well, let it be known. And I'm sure that our colleagues have interactions with the industry, either through the sales reps or the medical science liaison, or because they're involved in a clinical trial. That's probably the best way of getting into the industry is, frankly, leveraging the network. And then it takes a little bit of work, though, to determine which company or companies would be the best fit, given my interest, given my expertise, given my experience, given my location. All these come into play. But probably the key, again, is let it be known that you are interested, and that's probably the best way to get in.
Are there networking opportunities for physicians who want to make an entry into this industry? Or as you said before, is it as you have contact with people in the industry, you make them aware of it? I wasn't sure how formal the process was, or as in your case, you fortuitously you found out about an opportunity that may or may not even have been quote unquote posted, and you took advantage of it. How Is that still common today, or is it a more formalized process today?
It's a little bit of both. So I know that physicians participate in medical conferences, for example, and most companies participate in medical conferences as well. I mean, this is an obvious intersection point here. The second has to do with any connection that physicians have within the industry, either, as I said, through their medical science liaison or the sales rep. I mean, these are also relatively straightforward. And the third aspect, as I said, is also participating in clinical trials. This is, in my experience, probably the most common avenue of getting into the industry is being an investigator in a clinical trial, and all of a sudden you are known to the company knows you. Then you say, you know, if there is an opportunity, I would like to consider it or be considered for it. And this is how it goes. So that's probably the most common approach. Now, obviously, there are a number of headhunters that are specialized in the industry that cover the life science. That's another avenue where you prepare a resume and you submit it to a headhunter saying, if you have any opportunity that fit my profile, please consider me. Yes, but it's usually, I would say, the connection, the interpersonal connection is probably the best way.
And it sounds like people who have research skills or have been doing some clinical research are maybe the best fit for some of these positions. You mentioned generalists. If I were interested today in pursuing a career in pharma or life sciences industry, and I've been practicing as a primary care physician, seeing patients, maybe involved in some leadership areas in my practice, would that be the type of physician that would have an opportunity or a high likelihood of being an interest to some of these companies?
Usually the interest comes more from specialists than from generalists, but it also depends on the type of position the company is seeking. So if they're seeking a position in translational medicine, clinical development, or research or discovery, then they look probably more for a specialist. If the position is more along the lines of regulatory, drug safety, medical communication, then a generalist would be a better fit.
And are all these positions part of the process of getting a drug through the regulatory environment?
Yes. I mean, virtually everyone in a biotech or pharma contributes either directly or indirectly to having a drug approved. So as you know, I mean, it's a process that starts early in research. Then you have preclinical work that is done, usually in labs, either in vitro or in vivo, which would lead to an IND, which is asking the regulatory agency to approve the transition between animal work and humans. And then you have the process of phase one, phase two, phase three, which are three different stages of a drug development, starting with phase one, where it's the first time that a compound is tested in humans. And the objective of phase one is to determine the safety of the compound, of the product. Then we move to phase two, which is usually in patients, but is focused on finding the right dose, among other things. And phase three, which is the clinical stage where we work with patients, and usually it's placebo-controlled clinical trials where a certain percentage, either half or one-third or one-quarter of the patients get a placebo and the rest will get the active product, which in turn leads to a regulatory submission to the regulatory agencies and then an approval. So at every stage of this process, which takes from A to Z about 10, 12 years, and is in the $2.3, $2.4 billion with a B. So it's a long process and a very expensive one. Physicians have really a role at every one of these stages. So if they're involved in clinical trial, the answer is obvious. They get involved in phase one, two, or three. If they're focused on safety, well, they are involved as a common denominator to all. If they are involved in medical communication, again, when we get to phase three, we start really talking to physicians about what the drug could potentially do and this aspect of medical communication. So yeah, there is a role virtually at every stage of this long, complex, and expensive process.
This podcast is sponsored by the Physician Executive MBA program at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville's Haslam College of Business. In less than one calendar year, this program will equip you with valuable business acumen and leadership development not found in traditional medical school curriculum. Are you ready to join the longest-running physician-only MBA program in the country and a network of nearly 1,000 PEMBA graduates? Visit tiny.utk.edu/podpodcast for information about this exciting opportunity. And now we'll return to the episode. From seeing all of the work that goes into the regulatory process and hearing the conversations that are going on in terms of the profits that are being made in pharmaceutical companies and in life science, what is your perspective on that from being in these organizations and being in the boardrooms or at leadership meetings when there are conversations around product development and pricing and those kinds of things?
Yeah, I mean, that's the eternal question, but let me offer a deal for you. So the deal is the following. Why don't you invest with me in developing a compound where our chances of success is about 1 to 10,000, and after investing, call it $500, $600, $700, $800 million, the chances of recouping any dollar is about 60%. And by the way, 90% of the companies, biotech companies, never turn a profit. So I'm not sure that you would be terribly interested in investing with me, right? So therefore, if you're an investor, you're taking huge risks. And therefore, again, PEMBA, application of PEMBA, real time, high risk equal high reward. So this is one aspect from an investment perspective. The other aspect, which is the following, which has to do with health economics. In other words, if I'm developing a product that will save the healthcare system a certain percentage of their expenses, how much could I price it so that there is a willingness to pay from society? And basically, most every pricing is done based on the model of frankly, cost-benefit. In other words, how much is society willing to pay for a product? It's correlated to how much society is saving by having this product approved and commercialized. And last but certainly not least, when you get into the area of rare diseases, this is a societal decision, because I was involved in a product where in the US we had 5,000 patients. So how much is society willing to pay for the company I was CEO of, NPS Pharma? How much is society willing to reward us for developing a product for only 5,000 patients? And thanks to the IP, to the patent extension products in the rare disease space, and the price we can charge, we were encouraged to do it, because otherwise it would have made absolutely no business sense to embark on this journey. So the notion of drug pricing is a common political topic, and we lived it. But here again, how much do you charge for a vaccine that saves millions and millions of lives? You know, how much do you charge for it if you compare it to the economic benefit, to the avoidance of death?
It's certainly been, I guess, in the last 5 or 10 years, I've seen, maybe I'm just more sensitive to it, but I've seen a lot more conversations, or we've seen a lot more examples, whether it's the pricing for insulin or EpiPens, have led to very controversial conversations within our society about that exact issue, in terms of how do we price it in a way that makes it accessible for people, that the government can afford to buy it, is even part of our conversation now, since such a vast majority of the products are being purchased with governmental payers or by governmental payers. So do you see that going forward in the next 5 years? Do you see that, I guess, what direction do you see that conversation going? It will be, and probably continue to be, a political conversation, it seems.
It continues. I mean, some things never change. You might remember when Hillary Clinton, her initiative to manage drug pricing, and this was years, years back. Mm-hmm. So this is this is a theme that has been going on for years and will continue to go on for years. Probably worth reminding everyone, the cost of drugs today in the U.S. healthcare system is about 10 to 15% of the total cost of healthcare. So it's not negligible, but 85% is elsewhere. We also need to think in the U.S. specifically of the intermediaries that are between the pharma company and the patient. We need to think of why these intermediaries are there and how to justify their profit. I prefer this profit to go as a discount to the patient. We also to think about the fact that indeed, Medicare and Medicaid are the largest client customer of pharma today in the U.S.
Right.
And there is on the other opposite end of the spectrum, and I would probably upset a bunch of my friends here, is I totally understand why Medicare would like to negotiate directly with the pharma companies. Why use an intermediary who's taking a cut? Why are hospitals overcharging patients? You prescribe an aspirin at the hospital, you pay it $5. Why? Because it's a profit center for hospitals. So it's at the end of the day, I'm someone who believes in creating value in what we do. And I'm someone who believes that our industry creates value, no question, for society, for patients. At the same time, I also believe that there is a cost-benefit analysis that has to be conducted. And we need also to take into consideration, as the European do, quality of life improvement that our drugs actually bring to the patients. And this is, at the end of the day, it's a societal willingness to pay. That's what it ends up being. Corollary to this, we see that for many, many years now, forever, frankly, the leader in innovation is this country. The United States of America is the leader in innovation, scientific innovation. Why? Because it's worth investing here in innovation. And those who invest in innovation has a good reward. Plus, we have a very good interaction between private and public science, whether the NIH or other organization. Let's make sure that while trying to solve a problem, we're not shooting ourselves in the foot and end up killing innovation.
Well, thank you for taking time to answer that question. That was a bit of a rabbit hole that I hadn't thought about asking you about until we got into our conversation. So I appreciate you being willing to talk about that. I thought your answer was very insightful. In the current state right now of the life science industry, biotech, are there specific sectors within the industry that you feel offer the most exciting opportunity for physicians who are interested in transitioning into this sector of the economy?
I mean, we're living an amazing, amazing period in terms of innovation. And I mean, we just scratched the surface of what can be done. I mean, we talk about monoclonal antibodies today as if it is, okay, no big deal. Mm-hmm. Well, it is a big deal. You know, we talk about mRNA. I mean, even my grandson, who's 9 years old, can talk about mRNA. Well, guess what? It's a huge deal.
Okay. Yeah.
When we talk about proteomics, when we talk about genomics, when we talk about personalized medicine, when we talk about AI and its contribution to drug discovery, these are gigantic deals, you know. But yet, probably one of the very rare positive aspect of the pandemic is the fact that everyone and their cousin can say mRNA. You know, when you think of it, that's huge. One of the gigantic advantages of ChatGPT, it has completely, everyone talks about now AI. Yet when you think of it for half a second, you see that these are major, major innovation, major breakthroughs in the way we think about science, we think about medicine. Recently, I was the chairman of a company that applied AI to drug discovery. And it's pretty amazing because, frankly, we're discovering or uncovering something that, frankly, we did not even know existed. And our scientists are sitting behind, they're not sitting in the lab, they're sitting behind a computer. you know? And that's a huge transformation of what we are living. So yeah, physicians can contribute in so many different ways, because this is an open field and we need the expertise that the physician can bring. We need the expertise of the medical sciences, because all this is fine and good, but ultimately we have to convert all these discoveries into a product, a drug, a medicine that we can offer a patient to offer through their physician. That's how it works. And any innovation that does not end up there is intellectually interesting, but practically not terribly useful. And this is where physicians can play, because they're a unique bridge, frankly, between science and patient. And that's where we're counting on physicians to help us do that.
Have you seen in your career the number of physicians who have been interested in transitioning from patient-centric roles into roles where they would be able to have a larger impact, a societal impact, or an impact on their community as a whole?
I hired dozens of physicians in my career, and the story is very common where I love what I do, but I'm fed up with the environment in which I'm working, and I want to explore something else. I'm checking you out, you know? So when I started in pharma, virtually every one of my friends would say, oh my gosh, you switched to the black side of the table. I was ostracized. Actually, at Pemba, come to think of it, back in 2000, I think we were only two who had any connection to pharma or life science industry in general, actually. So I cannot say we were different. Therefore, there was a little bit of a different approach, let me be politically correct. When you are in industry, you're not a practicing physician, and therefore you're kind of second tier. This has changed, you know. Because frankly, our industry is becoming more and more sophisticated. This is where innovation is. And this is playing as a magnet now. So it's a combination of the magnet of innovation and probably the environment in which most practicing physicians are working in today.
Well, I'm glad you brought up Pemba, because I did want to ask you a couple of questions. You went to Pemba in 2000, as you said. At the time that you enrolled, what were the main factors that created an interest on your part in obtaining an MBA?
Well, let me put it this way. I started in this industry in 82. So kind of 18 years later, in 2000, I was still in, and nothing wrong with that, but I was very much in R&D, medical affairs type of environment. My personal ambition from when I started day one was, one day I'd like to be the CEO of a biotech or a pharma company. This was an ambition of mine, which was totally unrealistic when I started. And then I found very quickly over the years that, you know, having MD after your name was a superb business card. So having MD behind your name is a superb business card, but it kind of locks you into medical or clinical fields. And I had the ambition to do something else or something different. And I had a full-time job, and I was not willing to stop doing what I'm doing and go for a traditional MBA. And I came across Pemba, said, oh my gosh, that's terrific. A, it's a physician executive MBA. Two, it can be done hybrid, which back 24 years ago was, oh my gosh, that's kind of breakthrough. And third, it can be done in 1 year. So check, check, check. And then I went to my boss back then, to my CEO, and I said, I'm planning to start this Pemba thing. And he looked at me, I'll always remember, because we're in the midst of a merger between two companies. I had a full-time job and we were moving from Kansas City to New Jersey. He looked at me and he said, there was a silence first. And he said, if you're crazy enough to do it, go ahead and do it. And I was crazy enough to do it, and the rest is history. And frankly, it opened the door for me quickly thereafter to move from a medical role to a commercial role, and then to a venture capital role, and then to a CEO role. So it opened the door for me to, frankly, meet what I ambitioned to do from the get-go.
You found that it did have the impact that you had hoped it would by opening some of those doors for you.
100%. The minute I added the three letters MBA, it opened the door, because now I was not only a physician, I was a physician with an understanding of the business side.
Would you say that the content that you got out of the MBA that was the financial, the economics, was the knowledge that you were able to leverage most effectively to create that impact?
Yes. I mean, probably the nuance between my background when I joined Pemba and most others is the fact that I've been in the business for 20 years, you know? What I found Pemba to be superbly helpful for me was to organize my knowledge and to expand the knowledge, and also to know where the experts were in terms of business. But I found it extremely useful, frankly, again, as I said, in organizing my knowledge, because intuitively over the years, I learned tons of stuff. But it was like, you know, like a melting pot and like a potpourri somewhere. And Pemba helped me like organize and use the right words, the right language, and frankly, be more credible in the way I say things or I do things.
What was the benefit that you got from completing your MBA that you least expected when you started?
That's a very good question. The least probably was that I discovered that I did not know everything that needed to be known when you want to run a business. I discovered very quickly that I had significant gaps. So even though I've been in the business for 20 years, it was clear that there were areas, frankly, I did not have any idea about. And it's not because I did not encounter them, probably I did, but I did not have the knowledge to interpret and understand. Corporate financing being one. I mean, I was involved in corporate financing, but until Pemba, I did not fully realize what it meant, how it can be done, and the metrics, the KPIs, and everything that surrounded it, even though I was involved. But, you know, you're involved, but your knowledge is two, where the appropriate knowledge would be an eight. And this is something that I discovered. I also discovered, frankly, that on the flip side, that as physicians, we're not trained to think business. That's not where we don't enroll in a medical school to do business. We enroll in a medical school, frankly, to treat patients. And the business component is very different. It takes a different mindset. And this is why we have a high casualty rate in our industry when we hire physicians. Intuitively, from, I would say, the first month, I can detect if someone will make it or not. And there's nothing right or wrong, absolutely nothing. But, you know, some physicians are naturally inclined to be in business and others are not. And very quickly, I mean, I learned over the years to make these decisions very quickly. After 3-4 months, it's kind of we come and say, you know something, maybe I made a mistake and you made a mistake. This is not for you. Or others, you say, oh my gosh, as if you're born here.
Well, it's interesting as we think about the physicians and the alumni from Pemba who are listening to this, what are some of those things that a physician should be aware of that might not make a good fit? I know many of us frustrated by the current healthcare environment when we're seeing patients. And as you said, that tends to be something that motivates us to look for other opportunities. But in your experience, have you been able to coalesce certain personalities or approaches to problem solving that tend not to fit well in the pharma or life science industry that physicians should maybe take a second look at whether this is the best decision for them?
Yeah, there are a few commonalities. The first one is the life science industry is an industry, okay? And one probably common thing that I see is because physicians are in the medical field, they assume that they know what the medical industry or the life science industry is. I can assure you the vast majority don't. So probably the first item on the list is if you're ever interested in the life science industry, please take the time to study it to better understand, because a lot of physicians come in with a preconceived idea, and I would say in 92%, the preconceived idea is wrong. So take the time to study, take the time to understand what the life science industry is, how it works, how it operates. The second huge difference is everything in an industry, in a business, most of it is a teamwork. As physician, we're solo practitioner, we're captain of the ship or captain of the plane. In industry, it is a teamwork. So again, I found physicians to have difficulties because they've always made their decision solo, surrounded by a medical team. Ultimately, they make the decision. In a business, it's a joint decision. Okay. It might sound trivial, but it is not. Okay. The other one sounds even more trivial. No one will call you doctor. You know that. Uh-huh. They will call you by your first name. Doesn't mean that you're not respected. It means that you're equivalent to virtually everyone else. Mm-hmm. And some physicians find it, I mean, as trivial as it might sound, they found it annoying. And the other component is most physicians today in their practice, whether they know it knowingly or not, they're running a business. Okay, so how to transport or translate or this knowledge into a big organization? Well, the first part is it's horribly frustrating because you cannot make your decision. Others will make it with you for you. It's a much bigger organization, a decision that will take you a nanosecond to make as in your practice, will take months, if ever, to be made in large. Third, you have investor breathing down your neck and you say, what the heck? I mean, how do they challenge me in what I do? I'm the expert. Well, they challenge you because A, they know the business, and B, it's on their own money. So this notion of decision-making is extremely important. It's a switch from being the decision-making maker to being part of a decision-making process, and that's very different. You will realize also that time is of the essence, and folks, especially those who transfer from academia, don't have any idea what time means in biotech. Every minute counts. And if I used to do a given something in an hour, it is required for me to do it in 10 minutes. And by the way, it's a 24/7 job, okay? It never mm-hmm. stops. And this is another big surprise. What do you mean I should answer emails on a Saturday? Well, Saturday is one day of the week, exactly like Monday, and there is an expectation that you're available. It's not that it's not a 9-to-5 job at all. It's a 24/7, more or less. So all these are, when you count them individually, they sound trivial, but they have a very huge compounding effect. I hired a physician who was a key opinion leader, and he did not show up to team meetings. The first day, second day, third day, fourth day, then I had to call him and said, you know, we had 4 team meetings and did not show up. He said, I don't have to because I know what I'm doing. He did not last. It was as trivial as sitting around the table yeah. with other members. So again, I'm repeating myself, but it's important. They sound trivial, but when compounded, it makes a huge difference.
Well, thank you very much for sharing those insights. I really enjoyed this interview and this conversation. I think it is going to bring a lot of value to the listeners. So I, again, Francois, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to join us on the show, and I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you, Norman. Thank you for the opportunity, and I can say that I owe Pemba a lot, and it's my way in my small fashion to give back. Pemba has been a terrific experience for me, life-changing, and that's the least I can do. So thank you for the opportunity.
Well, you're welcome, and thank you again. Have a good day.
You too.
Thank you so much for listening to our anniversary episode. Dr. Nader was a fantastic guest for this anniversary episode, having graduated in 2000 shortly after the program launched back in 1998. I really enjoyed Dr. Nader's comments, especially his perspectives on the value that the MBA from the University of Tennessee had on his career, helping him achieve larger and larger roles in the industry. A very special thanks to Kate Ashley, Don Leiter, Tom Brown, Christy Napper, all from the University of Tennessee, for sponsoring and supporting the program. A special shout out to Christy Hausler and Team Podcast Support for all their work this year producing the shows. Thanks also to Jody Stockton for coordinating the scheduling, managing the emails, and the social media posts. Pemba On Demand podcasts are released bi-monthly on Thursdays. Please join us in 2 weeks on November 14th, 2024. Our guest will be Dr. James Calvin. We are going to be releasing the live stream from October 15th, 2024, which focused on the development of a Center for Quality, Safety, and Innovation in an Academic Center. Dr. Calvin appeared as a guest on a previous podcast also, episode 21, back in August of 2024. He discussed his experience in navigating the COVID crisis during that podcast episode. If you haven't had a chance to listen to that, go back to episode 21. I'm sure you'll enjoy it. Don't forget to visit our YouTube channel at youtube.com/@PembaOn-demand, all one word, for the schedule of future live streams. Please subscribe to the channel. We currently have 42 subscribers to the channel, and we would just love to see that number double over the next few months. That wraps up our show for today. Thank you very much for joining and listening to the podcast. If you have any comments or questions regarding this episode, please feel free to add them in the comment section on our website, tiny.utk.edu/podcast. We love hearing from you and are happy to answer any questions you may have. I will add a link to the website below. Please also don't forget to subscribe to the podcast by clicking the subscribe button. Add Pemba On Demand to your podcast library today. I would also appreciate it if you could leave a review of the podcast on your podcast player. Share the podcast with your friends and colleagues also. Please take good care of yourselves, and as always, good luck with your future.